Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument is Thomas versus Guardsmark. Mr. Huizinga.
May it please the court, my name is Timothy Huizinga, and along with my co-counsel, I represent the plaintiff appellant Carl Thomas. The principal issue in this case is whether an employer may shorten the statute of limitations for a common law retaliatory discharge action from 5 years to 6 months, even where the employee has not knowingly and voluntarily accepted the shortened period. There are several reasons why this court should not enforce the shortened limitations period. First, the agreement itself is not a binding contract. The agreement is a curious amalgam wherein Guardsmark only promises to consider Thomas's application for employment and yet recites that the consideration for the agreement is its employment of Thomas. That confusion renders the document vague and uncertain as to exactly what Guardsmark is promising to do for Thomas. Second, the contract by its terms did not become binding until upon Guardsmark, until, and I quote from the contract, approved by the compliance control officer in Guardsmark's executive offices in Memphis, Tennessee.
Now, in fact, Mr. Thomas did work for Guardsmark for several years, right?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
He showed up for work, they paid him, there was conduct consistent with the understanding of both parties that there was an employment relationship.
Well, there was, but our argument, Your Honor, is that it wasn't pursuant to the contract because Mr. Thomas didn't know the contract existed.
No, but that's a provision for the company's protection, not his.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but we believe that the whether the condition precedent was satisfied goes to the heart of whether a contract was formed at all.
No, actually. You can only enforce provisions that are intended for your protection.
Well, by Guardsmark, by providing this condition precedent in the agreement,
no,
sort of gave itself the opportunity to take the position that the contract had not become binding upon it. So it shouldn't be allowed to both provide this condition precedent and then say that the condition precedent is waived when it determines it would suit its interest.
I would like you to discuss, if you would, the last point you make in your brief, which is even if we disagree with you and we think that there is, in fact, a six-month period of time and there is a contract and all of that, this comes to us on a 12C, and thus we aren't going to look at facts outside the record, and we'll take all reasonable inferences in favor of your client. He's suing for, in part, retaliatory discharge, right?
Right.
So he thinks he was discharged at some point. Do we have any idea when he thinks he was discharged?
No, we don't, because up until the time the suit was filed, Guardsmark was treating him as if he was only suspended, but that he was still on the payroll.
So I take it the purpose of these documents that you attached is not for the truth, but simply to show that there might be a set of facts consistent with the allegations in the complaint under which the six-month period has been satisfied.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, has he been terminated? Has he been terminated now?
Well, he was given his 401k distribution, and so that was predicated upon being terminated.
So is that when he was terminated?
Well, that would be our position, yes. That
until then, he wasn't terminated. Let me ask you, suppose he was suspended indefinitely, and the company says, hey, we're not firing you because we don't want to be sued for retaliatory discharge. We're just suspending you indefinitely without pay. Would you need any remedy in that case?
Yes, you would, Your Honor, because the employee, since the employee is not in control of the termination of the employment or whether it's deemed a suspension or termination, could deem that they've been terminated by operation of law. In other words,
what does that mean, termination by operation of law?
Well, it means that the employer essentially would be stopped from denying that they were terminated if they've been suspended for a period of time within which a reasonable person would believe that they were terminated.
Well, suppose the company says you're suspended indefinitely without pay. Now, is it your position that the employee has no remedy until, some amount of time has passed? He has to just cool his heels, hoping he might be reinstated, or what?
Well, I believe it depends upon the nature of the action. For example...
Well, I just said what the action was. You're suspended indefinitely without pay. Now, does the employee have a remedy at that point, or does he have to wait?
Well, I believe that... the employee would have to wait for a period of time, and
well, I don't really understand that. I mean, he's suspended indefinitely without. So the briefs talk about a tort of retaliatory discharge. Is there any concept in Illinois law of retaliation that doesn't take the form of discharge?
No, Your Honor. The Illinois Supreme Court specifically restricted the tort to only where there is a discharge. There was a case where somebody was suspended, and the court found that the tort didn't apply in that situation.
So if they said to an employee, well, we're not firing you, we're just reducing your wage to a penny an hour, that doesn't violate Illinois law?
Not under the current case law.
Well, that's absurd. That's obviously not true.
But I think that the...
That would be constructive discharge. Has he gotten another job?
Yes, he has.
When did he get the other job?
I believe it was around March of...
Well, it's before or after the 401k issue was resolved.
I think it was after.
Is that in the record?
No. What I was trying to say earlier was that, well, for example, he did apply for unemployment benefits, and the Illinois Department of Employment Security sort of had this rule of thumb that if you've been suspended for a week or more, you're deemed to be unemployed for purposes of whether you can collect unemployment benefits.
So when did he apply for unemployment benefits?
Well, he actually didn't apply for quite some time. I believe he applied in March of 2002.
March of 2002? When was the suit brought?
No, I'm sorry. It was March of 2002. The suit was brought October 31 of 2002. But I think there's just a distinction between sort of whose ox is being gored in terms of whether or not you allow a party to impute that the law regards an employment as terminated. I think the employee has more leverage there because the employee doesn't control the terms of the separation.
Is there any evidence, could there be any evidence, I suppose should be the right question given the 12C, how often Guardsmark brings back people from suspensions? Would it make any difference if suspensions at Guardsmark really are suspensions and half the time the people are brought back within let's say a year, and or versus the situation where when Guardsmark suspends, they just like to use the euphemism suspended when they really mean discharge.
There's no evidence either way on that, Your Honor.
There wouldn't be at 12C, but I'm wondering whether such evidence would be relevant to the kinds of questions we're talking about.
Well, we think it would be highly relevant, and Guardsmark certainly should be able to have to at least explain why Thomas was suspended rather than terminated. If in fact it wasn't,
and what it means in the context of that company,
I see that I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heisinger. Mr. Howe.
Good morning, Your Honors. I have two brief points. First, I apologize to the court for the inadvertent omission on the statement of jurisdiction having to do with diversity. We submitted our response to the rule to show cause on Friday. I'm happy to answer any questions about it. It was an oversight. It will be attended to in the future in any future appeals. Second, with respect to the issues on this case, Your Honor, we believe this is a simple case with a simple issue. Plaintiff would have the court consider a variety of issues.
Why didn't you just fire this guy instead of indefinitely suspend him?
Well, for purposes of the appeal, it certainly would have been better if Mr. Healy had simply said the words to Mr. Thomas, "You're fired." The record does not support that. The record is that on or about November 16, 2001, Mr. Healy told Mr. Thomas that he was indefinitely suspended for violation of Guardsmark policies. And since that date, Guardsmark had refused to reinstate him, to allow Mr. Thomas to work, or to pay him.
But you know, the thing that worries me about this, Mr. Howe, first of all, is that it is a 12C context, and secondly, the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Melton against Central Illinois Public Service, which does draw a distinction between a suspension and a discharge. And if the Illinois courts, here we are, you know, in diversity, if that's a distinction the Illinois courts draw, then it strikes me that at that last phase of Mr. Thomas's argument that we were discussing, there are facts that could make a difference. You know, when did you do things that were consistent with discharge and inconsistent with suspension? What does this company ordinarily do as a matter of practice? This is all facts yet to be developed in the record, given the procedural posture of the case.
Your Honor, I understand your concern, and this could be remanded and discovery would be taken, but the plaintiff had a full and fair opportunity below and before this court to seek to develop the record or to make any type of assertions that it wished.
Well, he didn't. If it's a judgment on the pleadings, that's what a judgment on the pleadings is trying to test, is whether, in that case, the complaint and the answer state anything that's legally cognizable.
Well, the plaintiff is correct. The 12C standard is essentially the same as the 12C6 standard, and the plaintiff can seek to adduce allegations, even unsubstantial factual allegations, which have not been made in the complaint.
Well, you can show any set of facts consistent with the allegations, and if you had thought that there were a few extra facts, it's certainly quite possible to say we need to move on to summary judgment, do your discovery, present your documents, and be done with it. But that's not what happened here.
Your Honor, 2 points. One, the plaintiff, even on appeal, hasn't developed additional facts.
He's not supposed to.
Let me ask you a related question, if I can. What is your view as to when his cause of action accrued? The day he was suspended?
November 16, 2001, and the reason for that is...
So you're treating indefinite suspension without pay as the equivalent of discharge.
Yes, and Your Honor, there are a variety of reasons for why I take that position. One, the plaintiff himself, in his briefs to this court, the opening brief, it said that the issue was not when he was terminated, but whether it was effective termination, and the plaintiff himself admitted in his opening brief that to have a cause of action, he need not specify the precise date of the termination. Two, the case law is that there are no magic words that are required to terminate an employee.
Judge Wood's question is very pertinent. Don't we need facts in order to know? Granted, there are no magic words, but don't we have to know whether for this employer in this situation, indefinite suspension equates to discharge, and that Thomas should have known it? I think I'm going to suggest it's kind of legal rule that indefinite suspension without pay is always discharge, period.
Your Honor, the court need not reach that conclusion in order to affirm below, because...
But how, when we don't have any facts?
Well, Your Honor, the language of the limitations clause at issue in the contract was not as has been in other cases before this court, that a suit must be brought by a certain date from within a certain time from the date of discharge, but rather it must be brought within 6 months from when the cause of action arose. And here, the law
you're trying to rely on such a shortened statute of limitations in this contract, and then you have to fiddle around trying to figure out what the date is when this clock starts to run. That's the problem, I think.
Your Honor, the concern that each of you have expressed is essentially the same. The facts on the record upon which you can base the decision to affirm are undisputed. One, the plaintiff was indefinitely suspended on or about November 16, 2001. Two, since that date, Guards Marquez refused to reinstate him or to allow him to perform services or to pay him. The plaintiff concluded that one and one equals two. The plaintiff's lawyers did that in correspondence with Guards Mark before filing suit, where there had been the statement made that the plaintiff was effectively terminated on or about November 16, 2001. And the plaintiff had made the same conclusion in his lawsuit, because after all, an essential element of a retaliatory discharge claim is that there has to be a discharge. So the plaintiff had concluded that those two facts gave rise to effective discharge for purposes of seeking a legal remedy. The plaintiff has known those facts since on or about November 16, 2001. And this court need not determine the precise date if it concludes that some reasonable time must pass, simply that the plaintiff had waited too long by the time he had filed the lawsuit.
Well, first you say, now you're saying too long, but I thought you said one day would be too long.
Your Honor, that is correct. I am saying that one day is too long, but I understand that some members of the panel may not concur with my view of that. Your Honors, for those reasons, I would respectfully request that the Court affirm below.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Howell. Mr. Heisinger, do you have anything further?
Your Honor, I think it needs to be remembered that GuardSmart drafted this agreement and that it bears the burden of showing that the limitations period began to run on a date certain. I also want to remind the Court that the record shows Mr. Thomas had absolutely no idea that there was this shortened statute of limitations. And a statute of limitations that's in a publicly available statute is reasonable even if it's only 6 months, because a lawyer can look it up. But when it's on a document, a contract, the only place in the world where that 6 month limitations period is known is on
that. That's a really bad argument, because it's a lot easier for someone to find out a limitations period in his own contract than to find it in the statute book.
Well, if he had a copy, Your Honor, but he was not given a copy of the contract. That's in the record.
He could ask for a copy, couldn't he?
Well, it's not clear from the record whether he could have or could not have. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heisinger. Mr. Howell?